Chapter 6. It was a moonless, slightly covered night, and all along the shore the embers glowed a lovely red in the darkness, brightening at every breath of air from the sea. The deserted fires, round which surprises, daisies, and friendly islanders had danced and sung with such echoing zeal, that at last both Jack and Stephen laid aside their bows and turned to the grinding and making of coffee over a spirit stove. For Killick was one of the liberty men, and the galley fires were out in the sleeping ship, and then to backgammon. When each had scored two hits, they ate some of the piled tray of small, exquisitely scented bananas, and after a considering pause, Jack said, "When we were off Norfolk Island, I received orders by that cutter, as you know. I've not spoken about them until now, because unlike most of my orders of anything but a purely naval kind, they didn't mention your name. They didn't say, 'You will seek the advice of Dr. Maturin.' Then they not only told me that British ships and British seamen were being misused in Oahu, as you also know, but they went on to say there were two parties at war in the island, more or less evenly balanced, and that, having dealt with the ships, or rather that in addition to dealing with the ships, I was to back whichever side was more likely to acknowledge King George. And since I know what you think of empires and colonies, I didn't like to make you a party to what you disapprove." He took yet another banana, deliberately peeling it, and ate it. Stephen was a perfect listener. He never interrupted, he didn't fidget or look privately at the time. Yet, although Jack was used to it, he found polite, neutral, attentive silence during so long and delicate a speech somewhat unnerving. And while he ate his banana and arranged his coming words, some odd region of his mind said that this awkwardness was particularly unfair. He knew perfectly well that Stephen had received countless orders which he never disclosed or spoke about. "Yet, on the other hand," he went on, "it occurred to me then, and it occurs to me now with far greater strength, that the reason the orders didn't mention your name was that the people in Sydney didn't suppose you capable of giving advice about anything other than medicine. At present, I'm sure of it. Furthermore, Wainwright, who's just come from Oahu and who seems to be perfectly reliable, tells me that the two sides are no longer equally balanced. A French privateer commander sailing under the American flag, but with a crew of Frenchmen, has joined the northern chief against the ruler of the south, a woman. And his intention, when both north and south have worn one another out, is to destroy the chief men of his allies and opponents, and turn the place into a paradise in which the survivors and the French colonists are to hold everything in common. No wealth, no poverty." He reflected, paraphrased Wainwright's account more fully, more accurately, and said, "His name is Jean Doutard." At this, Stephen's face showed a sudden life, a glow of satisfaction. "What joy!" he cried. "It couldn't be improved." "You know him?" cried Jack. "I do, too. He's written about equality, the perfectibility of human nature, and the essential goodness of mankind for many years. He judges others by himself, poor soul, and he has a considerable following. I was acquainted with him in Paris, and once, to my surprise, I saw him at Honfleur, sailing about in a very spirited way in a boat with two masts. In personal relations, a kinder man never breathed. And in his system, the whole purpose was for the good of others. He spent a fortune in trying to settle the Jews in Suriname, and another, for he's very rich, in farms and manufactories for young criminals. But although I believe that the man who told Captain Wainwright of Doutard's deliberate Machiavellian desire of knocking his Polynesian associates on the head may have been a little excessive, I have no doubt that, in defence of a system, Doutard could be utterly ruthless. A very short way indeed with dissenters. And the result, though perhaps not the sin, might be much the same. One of his books on the Pacific Paradise infected that American naval officer. Killick, what are you doing to that young woman? He called through the open stern window. Nothing, sir, said Killick instantly. And after a gasping pause, it's quite all right, it's perfectly natural. I was just saying good night, which she pulled me across the Liberty boat, having gone too soon. Killick, come aboard at once, said Jack. Which the boarding nettings rigged, sir. I thought to creep up by the quarter gallery, but you ain't turned in yet, said Killick in a tremulous voice, though he did extract some hint of grievance and hard usage from their sitting up so late. Come in by the sash light, said Jack. The sash light could be reached by a spring from the canoe. Killick, though totty from his swing, attempted it, fell back into the sea, sending up a phosphorescent splash like a moderately good firework, tried again, and this time grasped the sill. But he hung there gasping, and it wasn't until the young woman with a shriek of laughter had shoved him from behind that he came inboard, sodden, resentful, and sadly out of countenance, going straight through the door with a bowed head, a mumble and a gesture towards his forelock. They sat back, each secretly pleased with having acquired a moral advantage over Killick at last. And Jack returned to the paragraph in his orders in which it was stated that in any event Oahu already belonged to the British Crown, Cook having taken possession of the archipelago in 1778. Stephen said, I believe the same applies to a very great many other places in the Pacific Ocean. I remember Sir Joseph telling me that Otaheite, or Tahiti, as some people say, was called King George's Island when he was there observing the transit of Venus. Though indeed it was Wallace, rather than Cook, who discovered and annexed it. He didn't think the chiefs or their people took the matter at all seriously. And I don't suppose the lady in question would do so either. A polite formality, no more. Forgive me if I'm stupider than usual, Stephen, but what lady is in question? Why, Puolani. Wainwright's poor, weak woman, the Queen of the South. For I imagine it is she you mean to support, the privateer being allied to her enemy in the North, the doubly inimical privateer, both American and French. Of course, I'm sorry, she'd slipped my mind. Yet even if it were more than a political formality, being a subject of the very remote King George, God bless him, by all means, my dear, would seem a less dreadful fate than being under the immediate and present rule of France or America, or the architect of a system that roots up every form of social existence known to man, and that is very likely to hurry unbelievers or heretics to the stake. So, may I take it that you have no objections? Asked Jack, who was indeed very weary, sleepy and stupid by now. As you know very well, said Stephen, I am in favour of leaving people alone, however imperfect their polity may seem. It appears to me that you must not tell other nations how to set their house in order, nor must you compel them to be happy. But I too am a naval officer, brother. Long, long ago you taught me that anyone nourished on ship's biscuit must learn to choose the lesser of two weevils. On that basis alone, I may be said to have no objection to Oahu's becoming a nominal British possession. It was far into the silent middle watch before they parted. And Stephen, having looked into the sleeping sick berth, tiptoed along the gunroom with a dark lantern to his lower cabin in the hope of escaping the infernal din of holy stones and swabs, ritual cries, the wheeze of pumps and the clash of buckets that began before dawn. For he was a creature that needed sleep if his mind were to function at all, and he looked forward to his free day on Anamooka, a day of intense observation and discovery that would call for all his powers if it were to be carried out intelligently. Jack Aubrey, on the other hand, possessed in an eminent degree that ability to plunge straight into a deep, restorative sleep without which sailors do not survive. And to wake bright, sometimes intolerably bright, and efficient after an hour or two, no more. He had bathed, and he was cheerfully eating his first breakfast, served by a haggard, mournful, unnaturally submissive Killick, when word came below that a small canoe was putting off from the Daisy. It was Wainwright himself, and he brought the news that Tereo, the old chief, had arrived, had given orders that no market should be opened, no trading take place, before there had been an exchange of visits and presents. That was why the beach was empty, that was why there was no swarm of visiting canoes. "He's a very authoritarian and formal old gentleman," said Wainwright. "He rebuked Pakea for his free and easy ways and confiscated his red feathers. His presence should be coming off in about half an hour, and then you ought to make a return and visit him. I think it might be a mistake to start watering before you've asked his leave." "Is there likely to be any difficulty?" "Not if you handle him right." "Captain Wainwright, I should be infinitely obliged if you would help me through the whole of this business. There must be no misunderstanding, no disagreement, no time lost." "Of course I will, sir. But it is I that am obliged. Your Mr. Bentley's mate is caulking our red whale boat at this moment, and he himself is fashioning a new rider. Perhaps, sir, if you were to show me what you have in the way of trade goods, I could pick out a reasonable return for what you are about to be given. Bakea told me to the last yard of tarpon." They were turning over the adzes, axes, beads, glass balls, printed cotton, brass and pewter basins, when a pahi put off from the shore, paddled by girls and commanded by an immensely stout middle-aged woman. "That's Tereo's sister," said Wainwright, "a jolly old soul. It might be as well to rig a bosun's chair." A jolly old soul she doubtless was, for the habitual expression of her face had lined it with smiling and laughter. But at present, as she was lowered gently to the deck, she behaved with a natural and impressive gravity. Three of her maidens ran nimbly up the side to join her. They too wore clothes from knee to shoulder, being, as Wainwright whispered in Jack's ear, women of high birth, related to the great families of Tongatabu. They were taller and a lighter brown than the cheerful bare-bosomed girls in the pahi, and they too were grave. They spread out the presents, bolts of tapa cloth, dark red, orange, and its natural fawn made from bark, young hogs confined in matting, baskets of live chickens and dead wild fowl, which included a purple coot, and some rails that made Martin stiffen like a setter, billets of sandalwood, baked dogs, sugarcane, fruit and berries, and two clubs made of a hard dark wood with a sperm whale's tooth set in each formidable head. The frigate's crew stood on the forecastle or along the gangways, some few leering at the paddlers or exchanging nods and becks with those they'd met the night before, but most watching in silent admiration. Jack said to Wainwright, "Please tell her that I'm profoundly grateful for the chief's magnificent presence, that presently I shall do myself the honour of waiting on him with an offering of our own, necessarily less beautifully attended, that I shall ask his leave to water in his island and to trade with his people for victuals, and that at present I beg that she and these young ladies will walk into the cabin. Pray make it as elegant as you can." Wainwright certainly made it longer and probably more elegant, for the South Sea speakers of the surprise were seen to nod approvingly at several passages. And at the close, the chief's sister turned a benevolent face on Jack. He escorted them to the cabin, where Wainwright seated them according to the Polynesian etiquette, and Jack gave each a bunch of red feathers and some other little presents. The feathers in particular were very well received. The Madeira that followed, less so. Their looks of pleased anticipation changed to one of astonishment, in some cases alarm. But after a stunned moment, the polite smiles returned, and although they were a little artificial, the meeting ended with expressions of kindness and esteem on either side. Shortly after the party had left for the shore, Jack followed it, his coxswain and bargemen in their best. And about an hour after his return, successful in all points, Stephen first appeared on deck. Admittedly, he'd slept late, and he'd been long delayed in the sick berth, yet even so, he was astonished to see the sun so high and the day so bright. The ship such a hive of activity, the beach so thronged with people and dashed with colour. For in this brilliant light, even a pyramid of coconuts on the white coral strand with aquamarine sea in front and the green of palms and gardens behind, was a fine, living, tawny brown. To say nothing of the heaps of bananas, yams, breadfruit, taro roots and leaves, the baskets of shining fish. He stared and stared again. A pahi came in, the men and women of its crew all singing. They turned their broad, elaborate, beautifully built craft round the ship in the light breeze in the most seamanlike fashion, avoiding her cables. She was now moored fore and aft, and running up on the beach to unload yet more fish. A flight of medium-sized parrots he couldn't identify passed over the gardens beyond the strand. A green, fast-flying pigeon. But the surprise was a busy ship. The great water casks were already coming aboard, rising up from the launch, swaying in over the deck with many a cry of, "All together, way-o, handsomely there. God damn your eyes and limbs, Joe. Half an inch, half an inch, half an inch forward, mate." And vanishing down the main hatchway to muffled, but sometimes more passionate cries far below. And water was not all by any means. It had been agreed between Jack and Tereo that all trading should take place on shore, in order to avoid the complexity of business with 50 canoes at once. And the market was spread out wide, handsome, and remarkably varied. The surprise's chief kinds of trade goods, tools and everything metal, bottles and everything glass, cloth and the much-valued hats, gourds, beads and trinkets were in barrels with a seaman sitting on each. The bartering was carried out first by Wainwright, who set some kind of a standard, and then on that basis by the more knowing surprises. Their purchases flowed aboard in a steady stream to be received by Mr. Adams, his steward, Jack in the Dust, Jemmy Ducks, where poultry was concerned, and Waitman, the ship's butcher, where it was a question of hogs. These creatures had been arriving in ones and twos since well before Stephen was afoot. Rather small, razor-backed, long-legged, dark and hairy swine, inexpressibly welcome to the little girls. They were the same as the hogs of their native Sweetings Island in appearance, voice and, above all, smell. They brought back times past with such force that both girls wept, spoke to them in the Melanesian they'd almost entirely forgotten, and comforted them in their distress. They were penned on the forecastle until there should be time to enlarge the quarters below where yesterday's hogs were kept, and the animals were both anxious and frightened. Yet those below were in a still more wretched state, and when they heard and smelt others of their kind overhead, they set up a hideous din. This, too, was perfectly familiar to Emily and Sarah. They ran to Jemmy Ducks and told him the creatures were starved. They were calling out for food. For a great while, Jemmy, who was much taken up with his chickens, put them off, saying that hogs was butcher's business. But at last they pestered him so that in a lull he went up to Waitman, one of the very few thoroughly disagreeable men aboard, and suggested that the hogs below sounded hungry. He received the abuse he expected. Who did he think he was, telling the barkeep's butcher about hogs? Did Waitman tell Jemmy Ducks how to look after his fucking hens, or turtles? Turtles, kiss my arse. In any case, the hogs below had been fed. Had been offered every goddamn thing the ship contained, from bread to tobacco. passing by a prime bucket of swill, and would they touch it? No, squire, they would not. And waitmen would be buggered if he offered them anything again. They should be salted and put up while there was still any flesh on their bones, and if Jemmy Ducks didn't like it, why, I could do the other thing. About this time, repeated cries of, "By your leave, sir, if you please, your honour," had driven Stephen off the gangway, then farther and farther aft along the quarter-deck to the taffrail itself, where, behind a great mound of netting full of yams, he found Mrs. Oakes, gazing at the land, lost, enraptured. And her delight made her look more nearly beautiful than Stephen had ever seen her, and physically better, in spite of the remainder of her black eye. "Is not this capital, doctor?" she cried. "I always longed to travel and to make distant voyages, but I never did, except, of course, for..." She waved New South Wales aside and went on, "And this is what I always hoped abroad and the islands of the great South Sea would be like. Dear me, such brilliance! How I wish I may always retain it in my mind's eye, and how passionately I yearn to go ashore. Do you think the captain will give Oakes leave?"
"Oh, forgive me, ma'am," said Pullings. "I'm afraid we must clear the davits."
Stephen and Clarissa were separated by a gang of seamen, earnestly paying out an 8-inch hawser. She took refuge halfway down the companion ladder, her head on a level with the deck, so that she might not miss anything that might be seen through the passing seamen's legs. And he was contemplating the ascent to the mizzen-top when Padine thrust his powerful form through the press. "Gentlemen, dear," he cried, his emotion drowning what little English he possessed, "that black thief, the butcher Judas's own son, is tormenting the pigs, so he is, his soul to the devil."
"Pigs," said Stephen.
But even before Padine had finished speaking, it took him some time, even in Irish, with his terrible stammer, "pigs," he knew it was. An eddy in the gentle breeze brought him a smell that he knew as well as even the little girls did, or Padine, and that was almost as much part of his childhood as it was of theirs, for he'd been fostered with peasants in the ancient Irish way, and in their house particular swine walked in and out like Christians, as familiar as the dogs, and, upon the whole, cleaner, more intelligent. While in one of his Catalan homes he and his godfather had reared up a wild boar from a striped bounding piglet to a great dark beast of 90 score, with huge tusks, that would come out of his beech grove at a rocking horse gallop to greet them, frightening all but the boldest of horses. For him, too, although the pigs were eventually eaten, and eaten with rejoicing, they had a particular sanctity, at least in part because they were individuals rather than members of a herd. He and Padine walked forward along the waste, dodging between the baskets of turtles coming aboard on the one hand, the casks swinging in front from the other, and sacks of yams, sacks of yams. At the break of the forecastle, Sarah, the braver and more vehement of the two girls, came running to meet them. "Oh, sir," she cried to Stephen, "listen to the hogs below. We keep asking Jemmy to tell the butcher they must be given taro, but he'll not attend." Padine began to speak, pointing down the fore hatchway. His stammer allowed him no more than "mug, mug, mug," but his pointing finger and the increasing noise from below were eloquent enough. Stephen climbed to the forecastle, where Martin was staring at the starboard pen. "Good morning, sir," he cried. "Here's a pretty kettle of fish." "Good morning to you, colleague," replied Stephen, "and an elegant kettle it is." Over by the larboard pen, where he and some forecastle hands were reinforcing the barriers, Wakeman was saying that he'd fed the hell-damned swine. Details of what they'd been offered. Swill that would have graced the cabin table. Lord Mayor's banquet. And they wouldn't touch a morsel, drink a drop. And, lowering his voice, he'd be buggered if he tried again or listened to any prating poultry man. He was the Barkey's butcher, and he wasn't going to be taught his trade by any... His voice died away altogether.
You don't want to starve pigs, said Joe Place. They want feeding regular or they go out of condition directly.
I call it a cruel shame, observed Slade. Why don't you feed them poor unfortunate buggers below? Asked Davies.
Wakeman answered these remarks and others, laying out his case with such increasing emphasis that his voice grew to resemble that of the swine at their shrillest and most passionate. At this moment the frigate's executive officers were all either on shore or below.
This is a matter for the captain, said Stephen privately. He's already put off.
They walked back along the gangway and, sitting on the brace bits, the most secluded place they could find, they watched the captain's boat pull out through the many inshore canoes. Sarah and Emily tell me that just a little tarot would do, said Martin. They ran off, took a piece from that pile there, and the forecastle pigs flung themselves upon it. I pointed this out to Wakeman, but he'd have none of it. He's a disagreeable, surly fellow at the best of times, and now he's beyond the reach of reason. Pig-headed, one might almost say.
Perhaps one might. How I long to be ashore.
Oh, so do I, Lord Above. The moment we've finished our rounds, we may surely ask for leave with clear consciences. My nets, cases, paraphernalia are all ready. What shall we find? The Polynesian owl, eh? But before I say anything else, I must tell you two pieces of news that it was not fit to bring out on the forecastle. The one will rejoice your heart, the other, I fear, will sadden it. First, among the presents sent by the chief this morning were two rails of a kind unknown to the learned world, two different rails, and a great purple coot. Never a gallinule for our love. No, far larger and of a far richer purple. Without mentioning it to anyone, there being such abundance, I appropriated them as objects more fit for philosophic examination than the gunroom table. Very right and proper. What a treat in store. But you spoke of bad news? Yes, alas. Last night, I was turning over our collections, renewing the pepper and camphor, and on reaching the lorries, I went to bed, leaving the skins on the locker. This morning, all the lorries with red feathers had been plucked bald, and those of the cockatoos that had scarlet on their tails were mutilated. The wicked, false, lecherous dogs know they can get anything on this island with red feathers. And there is only one thing they want, pox and eternal damnation of the whole vile crew. Jack came aboard on the larboard side. This was no time for the slightest ceremony. And he was at once seized by Pullings and Adams with a host of questions. Seeing that he couldn't be free for some time, Stephen hurried below to see the rails and the coot. They were fascinating objects in their mere outward form, but they also promised osteological peculiarities, and Stephen said, it is our clear duty to skin them at once, and then Padeen will gently seethe the flesh from their bones in the sick birth cauldron. The liquid will no doubt strengthen the invalid soup, and we shall have the skeletons entire. Carry them into your cabin. It will be more discreet, and I shall fetch the instruments. He was down in the dim sick berth, rattling among saws, forceps and retractors, and he just called, Mr. Reed, there. I can hear you perfectly well from here, and if you persist in trying to get up, I shall desire the captain to have you whipped. When Oakes appeared. There you are, Doctor, he cried. They told me I might find you here. May I beg you to do me a kindness, sir? Pray name it, Mr. Oakes. If you go ashore, please, would you take my wife with you? She's wild to set foot on a South Sea island, and I cannot have leave with the ship to sail so soon, and so much still to be done. Very well, Mr. Oakes, said Stephen with a smile, as cordial as he could make it. I should be happy to wait on Mrs. Oakes in 40 minutes' time. Oh, thank you, sir. She'll be so very grateful. Stephen followed him, but more slowly, up the ladders.
"Mr. Martin," he said, "here are scalpels for two. If you will take the nearer rail, I will tackle the coot. I have just agreed that we shall take Mrs. Oakes ashore. You have no objection?" Martin's expression changed. "I'm so sorry," he said after a very slight pause, "but I forgot to tell you I was engaged to the surgeon of the whaler." The captain's gig ran hissing up the coral sand. Bow oar leapt out, placed the gangboard, and two seamen, one beaming, one severe, handed Mrs. Oakes ashore. She thanked them prettily. Stephen followed. They passed him his fowling piece, powder flask, game bag. Place, a very old friend, begged him to take care of the lions and tigers and them nasty old wipers, and the gig instantly put off again. "Should you like to look at the market?" he asked. "Oh, if you please," cried Mrs. Oakes. "I'm excessively fond of markets." They walked up and down in the sunshine, the object of lively but amiable curiosity, much less invasive than he'd expected. Seeing that he was with a woman, even his talkative girl of yesterday said no more than "ho, wow," with a discreet but knowing smile and a wave of her hand, and importunate children were restrained. Wainwright and the South Sea-speaking surprises showed them the wonders Anamooka had to offer, and even those who were not, or who were no longer ardent supporters of Clarissa, were pleased that she should behold their fluency and the extent of their knowledge. Twice at least they made the tour, pausing sometimes to look at the exquisite workmanship of the canoes hauled up for caulking, of the nets, the matting of the sails. Clarissa, as eager as a child to see and understand, delighted with everything. But while she was watching a man inlay mother-of-pearl eyes on the blade of his steering paddle, she caught Stephen's wistful eye following a pair of doves. Tilopas? And after a decent pause, she said, "But come, let us go a botanizing. I'm sure this island must have some wonderfully curious plants. Should you not like to look at the newly arrived fishes at the other end of the strand?" asked Stephen. Yet although Clarissa could be imperceptive and even stupid on occasion, there were times when no amount of civil disguise could hide a man's real desires from her, and in this case the disguise called for no great penetration. "Let's take the broad path," she said. "It seems to lead to, well, you can hardly call it a village, but to most of the houses. And I believe it wanders off into, could you call it a jungle?" "I'm afraid not. It is at the best but open brushwood until the distant reed beds before the forest. But you are to observe that in true jungle, in the rainy season, there is no seeing a living creature at all. You may hear birds, you may see the tail end of a serpent disappear, you may sense the vast looming form of the buffalo, but you may come home, if indeed you are not lost entirely, bleeding from the thorn of the creeping rattan, devoured by leeches, and empty-handed, with no acquisition of knowledge. This is much better." They walked along following the stream and passing three or four wide-spaced houses, little more than palm-thatched roofs on poles with a raised floor, all empty, their people being at the market. Other houses could be seen no great way off, half hidden by palms or paper mulberry trees, but there was little sense of village. And since the breeze was blowing off the land, they soon left the noise of the throng behind and walked in a silence barely altered by the rhythmic thunder of surf on the outer reef. When they'd skirted three remarkably neat fields of taro and sugarcane, a little flock of birds flew up. Stephen's gun was at his shoulder in one smooth movement. He fixed on his bird and brought it down. "A nondescript parrot," he observed with satisfaction, putting it into his bag. The shot brought out an elderly person from the last house in sight, quite close to the lane. She called in a hoarse, old, friendly voice and hobbled down to meet them. bearing her withered bosom as she came. She invited them in with eloquent gestures, and they walked across a smooth, bright green lawn to the grateful shade of the house, whose level floor was covered with thick layers of matting, and this in places with strips of tarpon. On these they all sat down, uttering amiable, mutually incomprehensible words, and the old lady gave them each a small, dried fish with a most significant look, emphatically naming it Putu Putu. Clarissa offered her a blue glass-headed pin, with which she seemed enchanted. And so they took their leave, turning to wave from time to time until the house was out of sight. Now the rising path, such as it was, still following the quite copious stream, led through young plantations of mulberries and plantain, and the sun, nearing the zenith, beat down with increasing strength. "Do not you find the solid earth wonderfully hard and unyielding after shipboard?" asked Clarissa, after a silence, the first since they'd left the ship. "It's always the same," said Stephen. "Dublin's streets might be made of plate armour every time I walk about them after having been afloat for a while. Furthermore, in a great city I feel obliged to wear leather shoes or even, God help me, boots, and were there an accustomed weight after the pack-thread slippers I ordinarily wear aboard, and the unforgiving nature of the pavement, I'm quite knocked up by noon. I grow fractious, and..." At some 10 yards distance, on the top of an infant sandalwood tree, he saw a beetle, a large beetle, one of the Lucani, begin the process of opening its wing covers and unfolding its wings. In a moment it would be in the air. Stephen was not very deeply moved by beetles, least of all by the Lucani, but his friend Sir Joseph Blaine was devoted to them. He was prouder of being president of the Entomological Society than of being the head of naval intelligence, and Stephen was much attached to him. He put down his fowling piece and ran with twinkling feet for the sandalwood tree. He was almost within reach when the animal took off in its stately flight, its long body almost vertical. But the breeze was blowing down the slope from the forest to the sea. The beetle couldn't gain height. It sailed on, making for the trees at between 6 and 8 feet from the ground, and by running with all his might, Stephen could just keep up. But he couldn't have run another 50 yards when the inexpert creature blundered into an outstretched branch and fell to the ground. Returning with his capture, Stephen found Clarissa in the shade of a breadfruit tree, bathing her feet in the stream. "I've found something even better," she called, pointing up. And there, indeed, where the tree forked into 4 main branches, there was an improbable cascade of orchids. 3 different kinds of orchids. Orange tawny, white with golden throats, flamingo red. "That's what I mean by foreign travel," she said with great complacency. "They may keep their lions and tigers." Having gazed about her for some time, she said, "How happy I am." Then, "Can the breadfruit be eaten?" "I believe it has to be dressed," said Stephen, "but when properly cooked, I'm told, it will serve either as a vegetable or as a pudding. Do you think we might imitate the 4 masked hands and dine at noon?" "That would make me even happier. There's been a wolf devouring my vitals this last half hour. Besides, I always dine at noon. Oakes is only a midshipman, you know." "So much the better. It's noon now. The sun is directly overhead, and even this spreading umbrella of a tree, God bless us, only just affords us shade. Let us see what Killick has allowed us." He opened the other side of the game bag, took out a bottle of wine and 2 silver tumblers, roast pork sandwiches wrapped in napkins, 2 pieces of cold plum duff and fruit. In spite of the heat, they were both sharp set. They ate fast and drank their sherry mingled with the brook. There was little conversation until the fruit, but that little was most companionable. With the last banana skin floating down the stream, the last of the wine poured and drunk, Clarissa mastered a yawn and said, "With the pleasure and excitement, I'm quite absurdly sleepy. Will you forgive me if I lie in the even deeper shade?"
"Do by all means, my dear," said Stephen. "I shall go botanizing along the stream as far as the reed beds just before those tall trees begin. Here's my fowling piece. Do you understand how to use it?" She stared at him as though he were making a joke that should be very strongly resented. Medea came to his mind again. Then, looking down, she said, "Oh, yes. The right barrel is charged with powder but no shot. The left has both. If you feel the least uneasiness, fire with the foremost trigger and I shall come directly. But it's always possible that any approaching footsteps may be those of Mr. Martin and the surgeon of the whaling ship. They may join us."
"I doubt it," said Mrs. Oakes.
Stephen Maturin lay along the branch of a tree that gave him a view over the reeds and into the little series of mud-fringed pools beyond. "There is such a thing as being fool-large," he said, "as a procession of coots, purple and violet, of stilts belonging to an unknown species with brown gorgets, and of other singular waders passed by within 15 yards, going from the left to the right and then back again. The larger birds walking stately, the little things like ringed plovers darting among their legs. And there is also such a thing as being too complacent by half. That woman didn't even thank me for the gun." He knew that in the last moments of their conversation the current had changed. He'd no doubt said something tactless. He couldn't tell what it was, just as she, being no natural philosopher, couldn't tell what he was giving up. Hours, irreplaceable hours of running about virgin country, never to be seen again, filled with unknown forms of life. Not that the analogy was sound, he reflected, climbing down. He didn't find her mood much improved when he came back to the breadfruit tree, carrying a respectable collection of botanical specimens, but never a bird, of course, without a gun. Yes, she had slept very well, thank you, sir, quite undisturbed. And she hoped the doctor had found all he had hoped for. He had no sense of hostility or offence on her side, but rather the impression that before, and even during their meal, she had reached too high a pitch of spirits, and that now she was suffering from the usual reaction coupled with physical fatigue. He also perceived that one of her heels was sadly blistered. Clearly it wouldn't be possible to drag her as far as the forest. By way of restoring something of the earlier tone, he told her about the little girl's triumph. How Captain Aubrey had brought the butcher up with a round turn, had ordered him to mingle a little tarrow with the hog's swill and to sprinkle some onto their grain. How they'd hurled themselves upon both with cries of swinish joy, and how the category of the animals themselves had been changed. They were now to be considered lambs, and therefore under the rule of Jemmy Ducks. "Sarah and Emily were delighted," he said, "yet discreet beyond their years, very careful not to exult over the butcher or to wound his feelings in any way." "Yes, they are dear little things," said Clarissa, "and I love them much, although they have taken against me to quite a wounding degree." An incautious mixed band of parrots passed within shot. Stephen chose two, killed them cleanly, and brought them back. When she'd admired their plumage, she went on, "I do so dislike being disliked. That reminds me of poor little Mr. Reed. How does he do?" "He is so well and active that I'm afraid he will get up too soon. I've left orders with Pardeen that he is to be lashed into his cot if he grow unruly. I'm so glad. We were such good friends at one time. Can he have any career in the Navy? I do hope so. He thinks the world of the service." "Oh, I've little doubt of it. Honourable wound, excellent connections, glowing report from his captain. If he's not killed first, he will die an admiral." "What about the other officers?" "Captain Pullings will almost certainly be made post when we get home.
Will West and Davidge be reinstated, do you suppose?
As for that, I'm no judge, but I doubt it.
The beach is littered with failed sea officers, many of them, I'm sure, courageous and capable seamen. Captain Aubrey was reinstated. Captain Aubrey, apart from his martial virtues, is a wealthy man with high-placed friends and an unshakable seat in Parliament. Clarissa considered this for a while, and then, with quite another look and in quite another tone, she said, "How pleasant it is to be sitting in the shade, just not too hot, with those glorious flowers overhead, next to a man who does not ply one with questions or with assiduities. You will not think I'm fishing when I ask, does my eye still show much? I have no decent looking glass aboard, so I cannot tell." "It can no longer be called a black eye," said Stephen. Clarissa felt the place gently and went on. "I don't give a straw for men qua men, but I still like to look agreeable, or at least passable. As I said before, I do loathe being disliked, and ugliness and dislike seem to go together. Someone once gave me a confused account of the little girl's origin. They're not Aborigines, I collect. Not at all, at all. They are Melanesians from Sweeting's Island, a great way off, the last survivors of a community destroyed by the smallpox. We brought them away because it seemed improbable they should live on by themselves. What is to happen to them?
I cannot tell.
An orphanage in Sydney could not be born, and my present plan is to carry them to London, where my friend Mrs. Broad keeps a warm, comfortable tavern in the liberties of the Savoy. I have a room there all the year round. She's a kindly woman. She has agreeable young nieces and cousins about the house. And I mean Sarah and Emily to live with her until I can pitch upon some better solution." Clarissa hesitated and made two false starts before she said, "I wish your Mrs. Broad may keep them safe at least until they know what they're about. May keep them from being misused. Indeed, I wish they may not have been misused already, plain little creatures though they are. They're very young, you know. I was younger still." A fruit pigeon landed on the other bank of the stream and drank a long draught. "As a medical man, you must have come across incestuous families."
"Often and often."
"Though perhaps incest is too strong a word as far as I'm concerned. My guardian was only some remote connection. I went to him when I was about the size of Emily. He lived in quite a large house with a park and a lake, very secluded, pleasant enough. I believe there'd been deer in the park in his father's time, but he lived almost entirely indoors, in his library most of the time. And he took no notice of poachers, he had no notion of sporting. He was a shy, kind, nervous man, tall and thin. I used to think him very old, but he can't have been, since his niece Frances, his older sister's daughter, was only a little older than I was myself. The servants really were old, however. They'd been there in his parents' days. He was a learned man and kind and a very good and patient teacher. I was really fond of him in spite of... I didn't much care for Frances, though since we had no other companions, we played together and ran about in the garden and the park. We were jealous of one another, jealous for his regard, and that did wonders for our lessons. My guardian, I call him Cousin Edward, for Latin and English reading and writing, and a string of unfortunate French governesses for the rest. They never stayed, saying the place was too remote. And it is true that the lanes were so narrow and deep that there was no getting the carriage as far as the church in winter except when there was a strong frost. Yet we weren't so very isolated after all. The tradesmen came, which was always an event. And people used to call on Aunt Cheney, the old lady who lived upstairs, but never left her room for fear of taking cold. Mrs. Bellingham drove over from Bishop's Thornton almost every week in summer. And when the roads were too dirty, she would ride across, taking the high country.
She and Aunt Cheney taught us how to come into a room properly and go out closing the door behind us, and to sit up and be quiet and make our curtsy. There were some others too, though my guardian disliked visits extremely. I said, in spite of, just now, and I wonder how I can explain it without being gross. We had various games. Cousin Edward played chess and backgammon with us and battledoor and shuttlecock in the big hall. And then there was what we called the games in the dark, with lights put out, curtains drawn, a kind of hide-and-seek. And sometimes he would catch the one, sometimes the other, and pretend to eat us while we screamed. Yet after a while it took a different turn. He was always very gentle. He hardly ever hurt me. And he seemed to think that though our game was private, it was of no great importance. Francis and I never spoke about it to one another. But when we went to school in Winchester, do you know Winchester? The question made the strangest contrast with her toneless monologue. Only by repute, I know little of England. It was a convent of French Dominicans, and many of the girls were émigrés' daughters. But when we were there, and we heard the whispering and giggling and wild suppositions about marriage, childbirth, and what went before it, we looked at one another with perfect understanding, though we neither of us ever mentioned it in words. It was there that I began to have some notion of what had happened, though I still couldn't make out why there was so much fuss. The first part of Foeda est in coitu et brevis voluptas I could understand perfectly well, but not the second. I couldn't associate it with the least degree of pleasure, however short. And so a great deal that I read and heard, romantic attachments, swimming the Hellespont and so on, remained incomprehensible in so far as they were for that end, the right, true end. So we concealed our knowledge of these matters, and we soon learned to control our learning, too. We knew far more Latin than the other girls. That was one of the reasons for our unpopularity. My violence was another. When we came back from school, for eventually the nuns wouldn't keep me any longer, and I can't blame them, we found everything changed. Aunt Cheney had died. Many of the servants had been turned away. Nobody called any more. Only the library and the lessons were the same, and the game in the dark. But then after a while, Mr. Southam joined in. He was the last remaining visitor. An officer in the army, a big, coarse, arrogant man with some very nasty ways. Cousin Edward said we were to be particularly kind to him. We hid as hard as ever we could when he was there. But that was mostly because of his smell and general unpleasantness. The thing itself was of no consequence. And so life went on very slowly. And it seemed to be winter and chilblains most of the time. Only the library was heated. Everything grew poorer and poorer. The silver disappeared. Gypsies camped in the park on the far side of the lake where the wall had fallen down. And the garden was head high with weeds. All the servants left, except for two very old women who could get no other work and who preferred staying to the poorhouse. The tradesmen stopped calling. The coach had been laid up long since, and a little while before Francis was sent away into Yorkshire, we dwindled from a gig to an ass cart. And in this, when the roads were passable, Cousin Edward went to Alton with a basket. In winter, although he hated riding, he took the pony. I never saw Francis again, by the way, nor heard what became of her. Looking back now, I suppose they got her in child, and either bearing or getting rid of it killed her. An orchid flower fell in her lap.
She looked at it, turning it this way and that, and presently she carried on with her oddly jerking narrative, not unlike inward speech with its own references and allusions. It was the pony, indeed, that was the death of him. Some farm labourers found him thrown down on the road and brought him back on a hurdle. Mrs. Bellingham of Bishop's Thornton saw him properly buried. There was a fair congregation, and they said my friends would no doubt come for me. The only people who came were Mr. Southam and some lawyer's men who went all over the house writing everything down. He told me I was penniless. No provision had been made for me, but he would find me work in St. James's. Do you know St. James's? Once again her voice changed entirely to a waking tone. Certainly I know it, said Stephen. Don't I stay at Black's every time I'm in London? Say you're a member of Black's. Stephen bowed. I used to work on the other side of the road, or rather, beyond the other side of the road, behind Button's. Yes, at Mother Abbott's. But I always had a kindness for Black's, because it was a member that begged me off when I was to be hanged. Did you ever go to Mother Abbott's? I have sometimes walked across and drunk tea with herself while my friends went upstairs. Then you know the parlour on the right. That was where I worked, keeping the accounts. One of the few things the nuns taught me, apart from French, was keeping accounts neatly and accurately. There, or in one of the little rooms beyond, keeping men company while they waited for their girl. Or sometimes they came in just to talk, being lonely. Mother Abbott was very kind to me. She taught me how to dress and undress, and she let me have clothes on credit. But she never made me do anything I didn't choose to do. And it wasn't until much later that I obliged, as they say, when we were short-handed and the girls were very busy. Forgive me, said Stephen, leaning forward, seizing a small orthopterous insect and putting it into a collecting box. It's an odd thing, living in a brothel, said Clarissa, and it has a certain likeness to being at sea. You live a particular life with your own community, but it's not the life of the world in general, and you tend to lose touch with the world in general's ideas and language, all sorts of things like that. So that when you go out, you are as much a stranger as a sailor is on shore. Not that I had much notion of the world in general anyhow, the ordinary, normal, adult world, never having really seen it. I tried to make it out by novels and plays, but that wasn't much use. They all went on to such an extent about physical love, as though everything revolved about it, whereas for me it wasn't much more important than blowing my nose. Chastity or unchastity, neither here nor there. Absurd to make fidelity a matter of private parts. Grotesque. I took no pleasure in it, except in giving a little when I happened to like the man. I had some agreeable clients, or felt sorry for him. It was sometimes from them that I tried to find out what the world in general really thought. Obviously, on the face of it, Mother Abbott's customers belonged to the less rigid side, but they reflected the rest, and I did learn a certain amount from them. There was one lonely man who used to come and sit with me for hours and tell me about his greyhounds. He was part of a ménage à trois. His wife and mistress were great friends. He had children by both. And the mistress, who was a widow, had children of her own. And they all lived together in one house, a vast great house in Piccadilly. Yet he and they and everyone about him were received everywhere, prodigiously respected. So where's the truth of all this outcry against adultery? Is it all hypocritical? I'm still puzzled. It's true that he was very grand when he had his clothes on. The blue ribbon is the garter, is it not? So perhaps... They both raised their heads at the sound of a shot. That'll be Martin and Dr. Falconer, said Stephen. Oh, dear, said Clarissa. I hope they don't come this way. I've so loved talking to you that it would be a pity to spoil it with howdy-do's.
But, Lord, how I've burdened you with my confidences. I've nearly talked the sand down. Perhaps we should be going back to the ship. If you'll give me your shoes, I'll put them into my bag. You cannot wear them with that blister. As they walked down towards the sea, talking in a desultory way of the brothel's inhabitants, of their customs, and the customers' sometimes very curious, occasionally touching ways, he said, after a while, "Did you ever come across two men who were often there together? The one called Ledward and the other Ray?" "Oh, yes, I had their names in my books many a time. But that was more on the boys' side. The girls were only called in when there was something quite special. Chains and leather, you know. Surely they weren't friends of yours?" "No, ma'am. Yet, surprisingly enough, they did know some quite agreeable people. I remember one very grand person who used to join in their more curious parties. He had the blue ribbon, too. But he never acknowledged them in public. Twice I saw them pass one another in St. James's Street, and twice at Ranelagh, with not so much as a nod on his part. And they never even moved their hats, although he was a duke. Did he have a limp at all? A slight one. He wore a boot to disguise it. Dear me, how hoarse I am. I've absolutely talked myself hoarse. I've not talked like this to anyone ever. I wish I may not have been indiscreet as well as intolerably boring. You're such a dear to have listened to me. But I'm afraid I ruined your day.